listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem may be on her way to Washington, but she still has priorities for South Dakota's next session. Our Dakota political junkies look at last week's budget address and a little bit about next year's session. Seth Tupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight. Brad Murdoch-Jurgensen is co-host of Dakota Town Hall podcast, and they are both seated in SDPB's Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Seth, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Murdoch, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back.
Awesome. Let's start with a little bit of some of the priorities that we heard Governor Kristi Noem lay out in her state budget address, which we believe at this point may be her final state budget address to South Dakota. Seth, what stood out for you in that address, in that conversation she had with lawmakers?
Well, just the fact that, with sales taxes being less than projected, sales tax collections, which she didn't really dwell on, but we learned from other sources before the speech, really, as she described it, some tough choices had to be made. And what really stood out to me was, what choices were made. She's proposing tens of millions of dollars in cuts to several different state agencies, Department of Social Services and Department of Human Services seemed to be the most hardest hit, but several other places as well, including SDPB, as you're well aware.
You can say it. We're covering the story. You
sure
can say it. Yes, that would be a pretty hard hit to SDPB.
Very hard hit. Yeah. And so, choosing to cut in some areas, but then at the same time announcing she wants to spend and I should say 1.25% increase for education and state employees and healthcare providers, which is less than inflation.
Sure.
But then in other areas, she wants to do new spending. She wants to give $4 million to start a program to start education savings accounts to help kids go to private school or alternative schools or homeschooling. And she wants to continue to fund a prison with $180 million to continue building up a fund to build a new prison. So I think that's going to be a major thing during the session is, okay, if we're dealing with a limited pot of money, which is a new situation, a different situation from the last few years when we had tons of extra federal cash and surpluses and from the stimulus funds and pandemic relief and that kind of thing. If we're dealing with a limited pot of money now, it's all about choices. And are these the right choices that we want to make as a state?
Seth, what's the power of saying we're going to fund that prison up front versus spreading it out over several years? Why is that so important to her fiscally?
Well, yeah, this is really interesting because, obviously it's just like if you're going to buy a house, you can finance it and you can pay, 5% interest on a loan for 30 years and you end up paying a lot of interest, right, over those 30 years. Be the same thing with a prison times, 20 or whatever with a project that's going to be, $800 million. So you save a ton of interest over the course of if you had to bond for that or, borrow the money. But at the same time, we always hear our state leaders brag about our AAA bond rating, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what's that for? It's to save money when you borrow money, right? If you never borrow money, I'm not sure what the benefit of the AAA bond rating is, if that's supposed to be the benefit of it. So I wonder, and I assume maybe there'll be some argument this session about, gosh, we've already put away a huge chunk of the money for that prison. Maybe you could borrow the rest of it and with your AAA bond rating have a great interest rate and avoid some of the cuts this session that you would have to make if you just took that whole $180 million and dumped it into the fund right now.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to talk about education savings accounts here in a minute, property tax or taxes in general. But Murdoch, what stood out to you before we dig deeper into some of those topics from the budget address?
The public broadcasting. That was the theatrical move of the budget, I guess. It's maybe inside baseball because all of us in the media talk about the media things a little, but it's school vouchers is the headline, and then the subheadline is, and oh yeah, public broadcasting. It was just so identifyingly unique out of the whole budget to me.
And did you see a plan for what public broadcasting does and what those kind of cuts would actually be eliminating? What there wasn't a lot of intention to it, other than she said we need to come down to a national average, which she identified. So in other words, we're paying too much for this. We could be doing less. But beyond that, have you seen any plan?
No.
For what happens next? Yeah.
No, I mean, there was headline driven and it worked.
We're
in
talking
a sense,
about
right?
It.
Does that
yeah.
make sense?
We're talking about it. Seth, did that stand out to you at all when you heard that? Were you surprised?
I was not surprised because I had gotten some tips about it, you know, obviously, that maybe this was coming. So I didn't know, you know, we had heard, as I'm sure a lot of people in our industry had, that maybe this proposed cut was coming. When President-elect Trump, you know, announced that he had picked Governor Noem to be his Homeland Security Secretary, I did kind of wonder, okay, is this going to take her focus off, you know, picking budget fights, and will she just kind of let things be and move on? So I was a little surprised that she still kind of decided, you know what, I'm going to pick a few fights in the budget here, but, you know, on my way out the door with only 2 months probably left in office. I was kind of surprised at that, but on the other hand, you know, kind of expected it as well.
Did you hear any reportable reasons for it?
For the SDPB yeah. cut specifically? Mm-hmm. No. You know, full disclosure, people who are listening may not know, I used to work at SDPB, so, you know, and the governor has made past statements where she, you know, has accused, you know, both NPR, SDPB, PBS, et cetera, of what she thinks is leaning left. And so, you know, I have to assume that she has some ideological motivations for that. She didn't say that in her speech, and she hasn't said really anything that I've seen since then. But that's, you know, I mean, those past statements by her are out there.
Yeah. Murdoch, did you think that was a political statement?
You know, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego is such a hotbed of liberalism? It follows the national, you know, you got to throw a bone to the Trumpy meat. I guess is an oversimplification of it, but it seems like public broadcasting across the board is going to be one of them things.
Well, we will talk a lot more on this show, obviously, as we cover the story about what that cut would mean for public broadcasting. You'll be hearing that on Thursday and Friday. But I want to return to the education savings account, Seth, and tell me a little bit again about the plan to fund those beyond SDPB. Let's get to the meat of what those ESAs would do and where the money would come from. And would they have the result of benefiting education or undercutting public education? What are you hearing?
To underline something with Governor Noem, we don't know a ton about it because, unlike past governors who maybe would have, you know, put out some embargoed information before the budget speech and maybe had a press conference after the budget speech and answered questions about it, all we know is what she said during the speech and what it says in her budget documents. So we don't have a ton of information, but what we do know is that she's proposing $4 million and that it would be...
For how much?
$4 million
$4 million?
For the program in total, yeah, for education savings accounts. And, you know, about $3,000 per student for what apparently is... You'd have to be lower income to qualify, but those details are kind of fuzzy as far as I can tell. And families could use that money, draw down from it to send their kids, you know, to help send their kids to private school or to put them in an alternative education setting like homeschooling or a micro school or whatever. And so she's claiming that, you know, this is school choice and this is something that people want and people should have the freedom to send their kids to the place where it's best for them. And she's claiming that this does not eat into public education funds. I mean, that argument is pretty tough to swallow, I think, for anybody who thinks about it. If you've got money labeled as education and you're moving $4 million of it over here, it's pretty hard to say that's not coming out of public education funding, especially when you're proposing only a 1.25% increase in funding for public education in the coming year. So you have, you know, folks on one side of the argument who want what they call school choice and want this kind of arrangement, who say this is about freedom, this is about educating our kids the way we want. And you have people on the other side of the argument saying this undercuts public schools and undercuts public education funding and erodes away at that foundation.
There's the other side of that argument too, where there's, you know, there's legislative appetite to take that $4 million and turn it into $35 million, right? And so, like, that's not a set in stone number right now either. There's some legislative appetite to want to make that 10 times bigger.
And to be clear, South Dakotans do have the freedom to homeschool their kids.
Yes.
There isn't a stipend for it. This is not a policy change saying you can homeschool or unschool if you choose your children, because those laws are set pretty freely. People have a lot of options, and there are a lot of scholarships, including funded by tax rebate for private schools and faith-based schools, Catholic schools. So those options are there, but this would be a way to financially support people in getting curriculum and finding ways to get their kids. So it's attaching a dollar sign to it. Do I understand that correctly?
That's what I take from it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then where the financing gets a little more confusing is then, so there's X amount of kids then not in the public schooling, and then therefore their funding gets reduced. And while we're having that conversation, don't forget there's this whole other property tax.
Yeah, let's pivot to that, because the property tax also would impact education funding. How so, Murdoch?
There's a new, I guess we're jumping a lot of topics, but there's a new property tax plan out there put out by Representative Enhuizen and Randy, is it Randy Daybert from the Senate? Okay. Seth is so good at this, he'll correct us if I'm wrong here, but it's a sales tax goes to 5%.
He'll correct you if you're wrong.
Yes, that's what I meant. Sorry, thank you. That's us nonsense. Seth, you've been used to correcting me. Sales tax would go to 5%. That would generate 280 million. That would then offset some property tax increases over time.
Okay, Seth, property tax is really important to Representative Tony Vanhuizen as well. So help us understand, you just reported on this, the nuances of the property tax legislation, which we're seeing really define the early days of session already.
Well, this is so fascinating because I've been really just really interested in this over the past few sessions, because in the past few sessions, legislators have been so fixated on sales taxes, in part because Governor Noem and her last reelection campaign proposed eliminating the sales tax on groceries. And we all know that led us into, you know, this multi-year fight where the legislature rejected that plan and instead reduced the sales tax temporarily from 4.5% to 4.2% at the state level. And then we voted on should we get rid of sales tax on groceries, and voters rejected that. And here we are after all those years. But meanwhile, the thing that I always hear from people and that legislators say they hear from people and that you see legislators run on is property taxes, you know.
Tried and true.
And yet they haven't really ever done anything about property taxes for the last several years. So there seems to be a growing feeling, and this was Tony Vanhuizen said this when he announced his intent to do this bill the other day, that, you know, that this is the year finally to do something about this. So it just come to a head, apparently. So it is fascinating from that regard. I think a lot of the, you know, there were 14 incumbents who lost. There were various reasons for that, but one of the reasons was a lot of people ran on reducing property taxes. I saw billboards about it out here in Rapid City. Some candidates made that a central part of their campaign. So there's a lot of political will to get something done. But, you know, what fascinates me is the batting around of the sales tax. You know, I just all the stuff we've been through the last few years. But in 2016, the sales tax was 4%. The state raised it to 4.5%, supposedly to pay teachers. Teachers now are 49th in the nation in average pay. And then we came back in, 2022, right, to lowered it to 4.2%. And now we're talking about raising it to 5%.
Imagine that phrase. Like, imagine walking into the legislative body and peering and saying, guys, 5%. You'd have gotten tarred and feathered in 2016.
Yeah.
You might get tarred and feathered still in 2025.
Yeah, and I think for schools, and there were some comments about this from the school lobby folks who, you know, say what you will about property taxes, it's pretty stable. You know, it's either going to stay pretty stable or go up slightly, maybe not as much as they would like their property tax revenues. But I think some of the school folks are a little nervous about being more dependent on a sales tax if, you know, they're going to change sales tax policy every 2 years and right. It's going to be unpredictable.
Right. How does this impact the conversation about the sunset of the sales tax reduction, Seth?
Well, I mean, this proposal would essentially just, you know, shove that all aside and raise the tax to 5%. So, I mean, that is still out there. When they lowered it to 4.2, they set it to sunset in 2027. So if they do nothing, the tax will go back up to 4.5%, in a few years. So it's just a crazy complicated, the numbers going all over the place in the last few years.
And who benefits and who doesn't? That's always the, you know, people who only homeowners will benefit from a property tax reduction. People who are food insecure benefit from a food tax reduction. But many wealthy people who are capable of paying a food tax, you know, they're going to get reduced too. So this is all also about who wins and who loses in taxes, Murdoch. And I'm kind of curious to know what you guys think about who has the political capital to get it done, And are there consequences to it? Because this is super complicated, and we saw what happened in the primaries, Murdoch, and there were consequences for the pipeline legislation, and there were consequences for not dealing with property taxes. So this is politically important as well.
My answer is no one has the capital, and are there consequences? This is the choppiest sea legislator ever coming into pier in the history, and maybe since the territorial legislature.
How come?
And
how come?
There's a lot of people who have never done this before.
Okay.
There's a lot of candidates that won on the campaign of fire and brimstone, and we're going to bring it back to the good old days, and, you know, the establishment's taking your whatever. You got to go prove it then. So there's a lot of legislators coming in trying to show how good they are, trying to impress everybody.
And on top of all that, we might switch governors in the middle of the
then
session.
There's an administrative switch, and then the national scene, you know, like, I don't know how directly it affects our local state legislature that Siri has fallen, but, like, you know, the ladder's rickety right now.
Yeah, yeah. The ladder's rickety. Let's talk. You mentioned Governor Kristi Noem, you know, a new governor, Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden, will presumably, again, we don't know for sure, but all signs point to Kristi Noem getting approved and appointed as Director of Homeland Security or Secretary. And that leaves a transition and a moment to reflect on her legacy a little bit. And Seth, you've been covering her for a long time. I'm thinking back to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act when she was standing behind President Donald Trump and she was in Congress. And then there was buzz that she would be Ag Secretary and she was instead governor, wanted to stay here for the people of South Dakota. That's some of the early opportunities that we had to see her attached to Donald Trump. And what are some of the early things that you think people will remember about her legacy as governor? Anything pre-pandemic particularly I'd like to start with?
Anything pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
Meth, we're on it.
Man, and you forget all about that, right?
I mean, but and where that takes me, honestly, is, you know, that honestly is the first thing that comes to mind pre-pandemic, because that kind of consumed, we forget, right. That kind of consumed her administration. It was a national controversy.
For people who don't know, the national controversy over an ad campaign that was supposed to reduce meth usage, and the tagline was meth, we're on it, meaning, hey, we're as a community, we're on this problem, we're tackling this problem, but the optics were just meth, we are on it, and it just didn't land, essentially.
And the pandemic came along, and that we all kind of forgot about that. But where that takes me is that when
I still see the bumper stickers that say,
"New governor,
we're on it."
I argue about this still. Yeah. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Well,
she was batting 1,000 till the cricket. The meth we're on it is funny, and it ages bad, but, like, you still see the bumper stickers.
Well, you could argue she's still batting 1,000 because she's going to be, you know, in the Trump administration, which is where she wanted to be. But my point was that when I think of her legacy, she is somebody who was great at bringing attention to herself and to South Dakota. And whether that was good or bad attention is something that will be debated for a long time and will continue to be debated. And some people, in some instances, it was good. Some it was bad. Some people feel differently. But she was fantastic at, you know, things like that. The Meth We're On It campaign, you know, getting President Trump to come to Mount Rushmore, bringing national attention to South Dakota when she did things differently during the pandemic than some other governors did, creating controversies on social media that put her in the national spotlight, and on and on and on. And that to me was the dominant theme of her time as governor, was being sort of a master of manipulating the public conversation and bringing attention to herself and to the state in ways both good and bad, probably.
Yeah.
I think you could write either narrative, right? It could age either way.
It's going to age both ways.
Oh,
right?
Both. Yes, that's a good way to put it, isn't it? Depending on your camp, it's already pre-aged.
Right. I remember traveling. I was in Hawaii, which is a long ways away from South Dakota. And we were in the hotel, and they had an art display up. And I stopped and talked to the artist, and she said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "South Dakota." And she said, "I love your governor."
Universally.
And I said, "What is it that you love about her? What inspires you?" And she said, "She is so strong. Her strength just inspires me." And that resonated, and that was probably 2021. So, yeah, depending on both narratives will be out there. And Seth, you write about should, and the word should that I remember you reporting on at the time, and you've, you know, reminded us about that. Say more, because in one camp you'll hear people around the country who really believe that South Dakota had done things right and admire Kristi Noem for her strength in that. And then you point at this little word called should and say it was a very delicate communication dance that she was doing. Tell us more about that for people who have forgotten.
The backstory on this, I got invited by the Washington Post to contribute to a compilation of short opinion pieces about Trump's cabinet picks. And they just reached out to some people who've covered Governor Noem. And do you have like a, they said, do you have like a vignette or something that really kind of illustrates who she is and her personality and whatever? And I thought immediately to this episode from the pandemic that to me is sort of like just seared into my memory. It happened while I was at SDPB as a reporter. I was sitting here in the Rapid City studio. She was having a pandemic press conference. And I had dialed into it, and you know, so had reporters from all over the state. And she was putting out an executive order, and we all kind of thought, okay, here it is. Here's what she's gonna. These are the orders. How we're gonna handle this pandemic, and you know, there's gonna be clarity, and there's gonna be you know what we're supposed to do. The executive order was, you should do this, you should do that, should. And then her press conference, should. And I was just mystified and aggravated because I was like, this is a crisis. We need clear communication. What is she saying? And I asked her in that press conference, you know, what do you mean? I mean, is this something that, are you ordering people to do something? You're giving suggestions? What? And she would not clarify it. And I really didn't know what was going on or what the strategy was or if there was a strategy at that time. And then, of course, as the pandemic wore on, she was able to capitalize on the fact that she didn't technically order anybody to do anything and say that, you know, she took a different approach. And that has catapulted her to where she is today. I mean, that was what drew national attention to her. That was what gave her the standing to attract.
Also had huge South Dakota implications too, right? Like the Sturgis rally happened that year.
Right.
A quarter million people showed up. I was there. And they all universally, if that block of people would have picked the new leader, she would have been universal leader for life.
Yeah.
And then, Murdoch, go back to what you're saying again about the book and cricket, because she was doing really strong, getting everything she wanted, and then that book really threatened to derail her.
I mean, you think about, like, the gender law on the ballot was part of her initiative. There was these things in place to, like, if she was going to get the opportunity to run for vice president, were there, you know, that were going to elevate her up. And then, you know, that book thing, whether or not she was ultimately going to be picked or not, or if it was just good theater, that book thing really took her out of the national spotlight for a while. You still see people wildly popular. Noem is wildly popular. When people come to the Hills or when you're out in the country, it's still a huge majority who are very big on her. But it did, you can notice the decrease after the whole book thing.
And this just underscores, Lori, where we were before with the good and bad attention. As you mentioned, you know, For a lot of years, wherever you travel in the country, somebody would say, South Dakota, you're the one with that governor. She's great. But lately, I also get, isn't she the one that shot the dog?
Yes, you know? There is the dog.
It's attention. It's good and bad. And and she's a lightning rod. And that's how I'll always remember.
It could keep her from presidential ambitions, but it's not going to keep her from being, most likely, from being the head of Homeland Security. But she maybe could have been vice president. We'll never know how these things play out, right? But we do know that politics is a dirty business.
Yeah, and when you think about her media tour for the book and how brutal that got, I mean, she could be in for that a repeat of that during the Senate confirmation hearings.
I suppose it comes up again, right? Just the Democratic senators.
Oh, yeah.
Everything comes up again. Everything that we have reported, everything that other people have reported, every time she's in front of the camera, all these things come up again because these are questions that people who are running for office have to answer. They're given the opportunity to clarify, and they're held accountable to their words and to their actions.
To your point, though, Lori, from earlier, there are two sides of this, and there, you know, it has pre-aged. If you know, so you already think one way. Most people, not everybody, already have aged this topic on their own, which is kind of a weird way to look at it.
And here on SDPB, you get to hear both sides with non-biased political reporting and analysis from our Dakota political junkies.
At least for a little while.
We will live it there.
Sorry.
We feel very confident in the story we have to tell, Brad Murdoch, and the support that we are getting from listeners and state legislators. I think we'll be here for a while. And we thank you for joining us. Don't just all go to Dakota Town Hall yet. there's room for both of us.
I think you guys will be here for a long time.
All right.
We're here for it.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.